From the heart of our nation's capital, here's Family Research Council President Tony Perkins.
Well, good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to this Tuesday edition of Washington Watch. Coming up, a deal was reached between the White House and congressional Democrats to raise the caps on spending and the debt ceiling. But is it a good deal for the American people? We'll talk about it with former Congressman Dave Bratt, who is now dean of Liberty University School of Business. And if you were in D.C. over the weekend, you couldn't miss it. The celebration of the 50th anniversary of the Apollo 11 moon landing. But what you might have missed was the role of faith in the lives of the astronauts who made the historic landing. The head of NASA, former Congressman and Navy pilot Jim Bridenstine, joins me a little bit later. Also, tomorrow is the day many Democrat members of Congress have been waiting for. Former special counsel Robert Mueller will appear on Capitol Hill before the House Intelligence Committee and the House Judiciary Committee. What can we expect to hear from him as he is pressed to say the president engaged in the obstruction of justice? Well, Louisiana Congressman Mike Johnson, who is the Republican that is managing that side of the hearings tomorrow, will join me here on Washington Watch. And physicians with the American College of Pediatricians are sounding the alarm with the U.S. Surgeon General, Dr. Jerome Adams, about the growing physical and psychological concerns over the harmful hormonal and surgical interventions in children with gender identity disorder. Dr. Michelle Critella, the executive director of the American College of Pediatricians, is here with more. The website, TonyPerkins.com. If you're on Twitter, it's at T. Perkins. All right, President Donald Trump announced a bipartisan deal to suspend the U.S. government's borrowing limit and boost government spending levels for the next 2 years. The president tweeted, quote, "I am pleased to announce that a deal has been struck with Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer, Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi, and House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy on a two-year budget and debt ceiling with no poison pills. This was a real compromise in order to give another big victory to our great military and vets," end quote. The question is, the deal that Congress must approve before they leave for the August break, the question is it a good deal for the American public? Joining me now with his analysis is Dr. Dave Bratt, former congressman from Virginia and the dean of Liberty School of Business. Dr. Bratt, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Hey, Tony, thanks for having me on.
Well, let me just start with this question. Is it a good deal for the American public?
No, it's a terrible deal for the American public. The debt load's up to $22 trillion. The Republicans have always stood for smaller government. The left is making accusations of fascism and all these crazy claims by the day. Fascism requires a huge government, not a small government. And so if you want to enable the government you live under to have enormous power, just keep voting for trillion-dollar budget deficits every year. And the Republicans need to start messaging on this, and this is the major problem, a year or two ahead of time. If you just run into the budget trap, the Democrats win every time on the spending war, because the Republicans have the virtue of wanting a strong defense. And so we fight for that. And the press never asks the Democrats, hey, how much do you want for the defense? They get off scot-free. And then Trump hands in a disciplined budget with cuts in it early on in the process. And the press, by which I mean the Washington Post, Politico, Roll Call, The Hill, destroy the president and say how mean he is for these cuts. And then today, if you go to Politico, you'll see their headline is called Deficit Don, because President Trump is blowing up the budget with too much spending. When just a month ago, the same journal, the same article, the same authors accused him of cutting and slashing spending. And so it's a media circus. The establishment, meaning the billionaires and the powers that be, are pushing this process because they're addicted to spending. The elites on both coasts are addicted to spending, and they're ripping off the American family and the American people. And I think everybody knows it, right, from Bernie supporters to Trump supporters. But it takes huge discipline, and the Republican Party needs to fight harder. And Steve Moore had an excellent editorial today in the Wall Street Journal, if you want to see that one, on the abdication of Republicans. But the Democrats, there's no doubt, are the spenders. The Republicans do marginally better, but they need to stand much more firm.
Well, it is a bipartisan problem because the Republicans, when they were in complete control, continued to spend. I mean, this isn't just a problem with Donald Trump. It wasn't just a problem with Barack Obama. And you don't hear about this. There's not a lot of discussion about it. As you say, the Democrats are the big spenders, but the Republicans have become the enablers of this. Now, this deal, it would raise the current budget caps by $320 billion over the next 2 years. That's $30 billion less than the Democrats wanted, but it's only half the cuts of the $150 billion that the administration had sought in the budget cuts. We cannot sustain this type. Well, let me just ask you. I mean, you're the economist. You know this stuff. I mean, we're talking about a budget that could lead to a $1 trillion deficit next year. How long can we sustain this?
Yeah, well, the conservatives always ask me that question. I said, there's evidence you can be pathetic for a long time, and the evidence is called Europe. And so you can be pathetic, but that debt will eventually impinge on your economic growth rate, as it has been. And what's really missed in the point is it's intergenerational theft, right? And I mean that quite literally. We are stealing from our kids and the next generation to the extent that our deficit is $1 trillion. We're spending $1 trillion and getting the goods right now, and the kids are going to have to pay for all the goods we're consuming right now. And so it is literally theft. So they're going to have to work hard, pay their taxes, get tax increases, pay off the debt, and pay all their own personal bills for our runaway spending binge. And it's just an amazing loss of discipline over the last, 20 years or so. I'd say it's a fairly new phenomenon that you're running into $1 trillion deficits.
Well, I mean, right now we are seeing economic growth. I mean, isn't this a time of plenty where we ought to be putting some aside? We ought to be reducing the deficit, paying down the debt, not increasing it.
Yeah, you're exactly. The classical liberals and even Keynes, right? Keynesian economics, which I'm not a subscriber, is big government kind of accounting economics. But that's exactly what he said, right? If you're going to run deficits in the hard times to prime the pump and get the economy pumping again, when you're in good times like we are right now relative to the Obama years when we were growing at about 1% annually, now we're growing 2.5%. I think we were 3.5% a year ago. And so you're right. That the theory says in the good times, you better start paying off your debt. And instead, we're doing the opposite. And I just encourage everybody to go out and look at the media, because that's why the American people aren't getting it. There were three pieces a week ago in Roll Call, The Hill, and Politico on the budget, and they never mentioned the budget number. And they never mention the size of the deficit. And they'll never mention the pain to the next generation. And so why won't they do that? They always say they care about the kids, right? Well, if you care about the kids, how can you put $1 trillion in debt on the next generation of kids? And so the compassion that they scream about is false compassion. And when you stand up and say, hey, you need to trim spending, they call you names when you're actually making the moral argument on behalf of the next generation.
You're listening to Washington Watch. I'm your host, Tony Perkins. My guest, Dr. Dave Bratt. He's the dean of Liberty School of Business, former congressman from Virginia. All right, you mentioned the moral aspect. Let's talk about the morality. And from a biblical perspective, let's look at this as believers, as Christians. The Bible speaks a lot to the issue of money, finances, and economics. And, I would think that based on my understanding of the scripture, we're not moving in the right direction.
Oh, sure. I mean, it's, if you're talking to just Christians, it's all God's money in the first place, right? We're stewards of that money. And so then you'd say the government, the primary function would be for the government to invest in things that will cause future growth. So the next generation will be better off. K-12 education would be good, higher education. And I mean education, not endless deans and infrastructure and all the corruption that's going on in education these days, right? So true investments in the economy and human capital that'll make the kids better off. And then if you want to follow the big 10, right, the 10 commandments, do not steal, I believe is one of the big 10. And we're stealing from the kids. The $1 trillion deficit is a direct stealing from the next generation. And we're spending it now. They're going to have to pay the bill. And so it's very simple. The Bible is simple. The truths are simple. Everybody knows. It's just whether you want to eat your spinach. And the American people are saying no. We want ongoing consumption and spending.
Well, it's
even if the
like,
next generation pays.
It's kind of like a monetary game of musical chairs, passing from one generation to the next the debt. At some point, the music stops, and somebody's going to be left standing.
No, that's right. That's exactly right.
Let me ask you this. I know we apply a lot of these biblical principles to we should apply them to our own personal finances. I mean, Proverbs has one that it's always stuck with me, is the borrower is servant to the lender. Is that something that applies to governments as well?
Well, it should. And I mean that's... I think the problem that you put your finger on is what's happening to our culture in the first place. And so the bottom line is the Judeo-Christian tradition is being attacked by the left. In K-12 education, you can no longer teach any of these values. You cannot give it that example of the biblical instruction in a classroom. If you're a teacher, you probably get fired these days. Mm-hmm. In higher ed, it's all run by the left. And the only ethics they teach are Aristotle and, the utilitarians and Kant, maybe, but no Judeo-Christian ethic is taught. And so what do you think is going to happen when you teach a bunch of academic ethics that no one lives out on a daily basis? I used to give Rotary talks all the time. I said, raise your hand if you follow any of those ethical systems. No hand. I said, well, now raise your hand if you're Jewish or Muslim or Confucius or Christian, and every hand goes up. And that's the very ethics you cannot teach for the first 13 years of public education, and which they reject and are destroying in higher education right now. So the American people need to wake up to what's happening to the culture. And if they like what they see, if they like the culture that they're seeing on the TV and the crazy shows and the virtue their kids are coming home with, well, then keep doing what you're doing. But if you don't, turn around, go the other way.
Well, let me ask you this before we run out of time, Dr. Bryant. When you look at who is buying up America's debt, when you look at countries like China, does that not pose a concern to you?
That one doesn't bug me too much. Most of our debt is owned by us. And, China concerns me. They're our number one threat for many other reasons, right? They're stealing our intellectual property and they're cheating. They're not part of the Bretton Woods liberal order. They don't know what a win-win business transaction looks like. They're building up their military, but the ownership of the debt, it would hurt them just as bad as it hurt us. And most of the debt is owned by us through U.S. Treasury bills. But it's just the bulk and the size, right? $22 trillion, right? Just write the number down and divide it by, 300 million people. And it's just staggering, the debt per person that we're building up, and neither party will say anything. And it's kind of like, unilateral disarmament for the Republicans, because the Democrats just say yes to everything. It's a matter of course. They get elected for saying yes to everything. And so it puts Republicans in a tough place, but that's what leadership is. You got to lead.
Dr. Dave Bratt, thanks so much for joining us. Out of time, but we'll continue our conversation, I'm sure, in the near future.
Thank you, Tony, for all you do.
All right, Dr. Dave Bratt, Dean of Liberty School of Business. A great, great guy. Appreciate him greatly. All right, don't go away when we come back. A big event for NASA over the weekend, the 50th anniversary of the moon landing. And what was the role of faith? We'll talk about it with NASA Administrator Jim Bridenstine. That's next. Don't go away.
Can United States senators interrogate court nominees on their religious beliefs? This is a controversial question that our country is facing today. In light of this controversy, FRC has taken up the task of answering this question with one of their latest publications, Rebels Without a Clause. We've seen in recent Senate confirmation hearings a troubling pattern arise where senators have begun questioning presidential nominees about their faith as an attempt to discredit them. These interrogations have gone so far as to asking nominees of their theological beliefs, church membership, and associations with faith-based nonprofits. It has been an alarming display of hostility toward religion and people of faith. Visit frc.org/test to learn what questioning the Constitution's No Religious Test Clause allows and forbids in the process of confirming judicial nominees. That's frc.org/test.
The latest Trojan horse on Capitol Hill is called the Equality Act. The way the left is advertising this bill is misleading because it does not further equality at all. It would actually violate current protections in place that allow private institutions and people of faith to freely act in accordance to their deeply held beliefs. The Equality Act explicitly removes religious liberty protections that were originally put in place with bipartisan support. Its stated goal is equality, but its actual result is harm to vast members of communities, individuals, and Americans as a whole by undercutting our foundational freedom of religion. Is this really what equality looks like? A more fitting name for the Equality Act would be the Inequality Act. For more information on the mass threat of the Equality Act, visit frc.org/EqualityAct2019. That's frc.org/EqualityAct2019.
Many advances made by the homosexual movement are based on the claim that sexual orientation is immutable or unchangeable. This belief was a deciding factor in the 2015 Supreme Court case that redefined marriage to include same-sex couples. It has been a key argument for LGBT activists fighting to restrict or ban therapies for people seeking help to overcome their same-sex attraction. But is sexual orientation written in stone? Should we brand people with an immovable sexual orientation label and tell them, you can't change, don't try to change, even if they want to? In a new publication from FRC, we reveal that sexual orientation can change. Survey data shows that heterosexuality is largely stable, but homosexuality is not. Even pro-LGB scholars are calling for the immutability argument to be abandoned. The question is, why is the LGB movement pushing this false argument? To learn more, visit frc.org/sexualorientation. That's frc.org/sexualorientation.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I'm Tony Perkins, and the website, TonyPerkins.com. All right, originally inspired by the U.S., the Cold War rivalry with the Soviet Union, the first moon landing on July 20th, 1969, is now remembered as an iconic moment for stargazers all over the world. 50 years ago, 500 million people watched. At the moment the spacecraft landed, Apollo 11 Commander Neil Armstrong said, "Houston, Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed." Charlie Duke, the capsule communicator, responded from Mission Control in Houston, "Roger, Tranquility, we copy you on the ground. You got a bunch of guys about to turn blue. We're breathing again," end quote. Well, Neil Armstrong made history by becoming the first person to walk on the moon. Hours later, as he stepped onto the moon's surface, he uttered the historic phrase, "That's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind." Well, after the historic moonwalk, in fact, the night before the astronauts re-entered the atmosphere, Buzz Aldrin, who was with Armstrong, took time to recall a scripture from the Psalms to honor his creator after his once-in-a-lifetime journey. Here is that clip.
"Personally, in reflecting the events of the past several days, a verse from the Psalms comes to mind to me. When I consider the heavens, the work of thy fingers, the moon and the stars, which thou hast ordained, what is man that thou art mindful of him?"
Joining me now to reflect on the 50-year anniversary of America's landing on the moon is NASA Administrator Jim Bridenstine. Jim, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Thank you. It's always great to be here.
Well, congratulations on a very successful weekend in Washington, D.C., there on the Mall as you celebrated the 50th anniversary of the moon landing. I know folks from all across the country came to see the exhibit there. It was quite something to see.
It was amazing. You know, before I was the NASA administrator, I was a member of Congress, and I've seen hundreds of thousands of people on the Mall before, but they're never happy. They're always protesting something, or they're always making an issue of something, many times a very legitimate issue. But in this moment, as people saw this weekend, we had 500,000 people on the National Mall, and it was people of all different backgrounds, people of the various parties, and they were all celebrating something monumental, something stunning, and something that was very uniting, which of course was the moon landing, July 20th, 1969. And so to see that many people out there celebrating something positive, It's just something that reminds us of how space exploration can be a very uniting thing for our country.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was one of those moments that I was only about 6 years old, but even I remember that moment. When that took place. And it was something that unified America. But in the midst of the Cold War, we rallied around that effort. But, you know, NASA now is talking about going back to the moon. There's more to be done in space.
We are indeed. We are taking direction from the President of the United States, and he has said he wants to go back to the moon sustainably. He said that in Space Policy Directive 1, his very first space policy directive, but he also wants to go with commercial partners, to go with international partners, and ultimately utilize the resources of the moon, retire the risk, and then go to Mars. And of course, we all saw this last 4th of July. The president very clearly stated that he wants to put an American flag on Mars. And so we are putting together the pieces of that every day.
Well, I mean, obviously, there's a lot to talk about in terms of the future of space exploration. But I want to step back for a moment because, you know, a lot of Americans saw the 50th anniversary, this celebration. But one of the aspects that, you know, they may not be as aware of is the role that faith played in the lives of these astronauts who went to the moon.
That's right. I really enjoyed hearing you played earlier Buzz Aldrin reading from the Book of Psalms on his way home from the moon. A lot of people don't know. On Apollo 8, our astronauts orbited the moon for the first time. We didn't land, but that was Christmas Eve, 1968. And when they orbited the moon on Christmas Eve, 1968, they actually read from the book of Genesis, Genesis 1:1 through 1:10. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And of course, that message, because NASA has the reach that it has, that message went behind the Iron Curtain. And as you identified earlier, that's what this was about. This was about a contest, a political contest, a philosophical contest. Which system is economically superior to the other? Which system is politically superior to the other? And of course, to prove our technological prowess, we went to the moon. And of course, it was the space race. And ultimately, that first broadcast from the moon. In fact, I don't think it was the first, but the broadcast on Christmas Eve, 1968, was a broadcast where our astronauts for the first time read scripture. And in that case, they read Genesis 1:1 through 1:10.
The federal government was actually sued over that by some atheists. Am I correct?
That's exactly right. The federal government was sued. NASA was sued. And then, of course, when Buzz Aldrin and Neil Armstrong went to the moon, Buzz Aldrin wanted to take communion on the moon and share it with the world and read scripture. And in fact, he did take communion on the moon and he did read scripture. He just didn't do it on the air. And a lot of people don't realize when they first landed on the surface of the moon, you know, Buzz Aldrin took a moment and his words were, I'm going to read here, I've got it quoted. It says, Houston, this is Eagle. This is the lunar module pilot speaking. I would like to request a few moments of silence. I would like to invite each person listening in, wherever and whomever he may be, to contemplate for a moment the events of the past few hours and to invite each person listening, wherever and whomever he may be, to contemplate for a moment the events of the past few hours and to give thanks in his own individual way. And he went on to read a few scriptures.
It's powerful to see behind the scenes as to the role that faith played in the lives of the astronauts. And, you know, it's a lot more common than people believe. Jim, we're out of time, but I know this weekend had to be a great experience for you as a Navy pilot yourself. And I just congratulate you on a great event, but I know it was a big deal for you.
Well, thank you so much, Tony. Always good to be with you.
All right, we look forward to talking to you more in the future about what's next when it comes to NASA and space.
Indeed.
Jim Bridenstine, Administrator of NASA. Don't go away. When we come back, Congressman Mike Johnson gives us a preview of tomorrow's hearing with Special Counsel Robert Mueller. That's next. Don't go away.
In states like New York, Virginia, and Vermont, radical legislation has been written legalizing abortion late in pregnancy, when babies can feel pain and are able to live outside the womb.
Happy birthday to you.
They've gone even further, repealing protections of infants born alive, allowing killing even after birth.
Happy birthday, dear.
Congress has yet to protect the life of every newborn baby. Visit endbirthdayabortion.com to send Nancy Pelosi a newborn hat to show Congress every new life should be welcomed with warmth and love, not hate, not death. End birthday abortions. Visit endbirthdayabortion.com.
Happy birthday to you.
Paid for by Family Research Council.
There is unprecedented religious persecution around the globe. In recent years, research has found increasing governmental and social hostility towards religious believers worldwide. For the last 10 years, Christians have been harassed in more countries, including the United States, than any other religious group. While the specific threats to religious freedom vary in type and intensity, one common source is the legal and cultural support for apostasy, blasphemy, and anti-conversion laws, which often threaten the freedom to choose or change one's faith. In a new publication from Family Research Council, we list which nations around the world have these unjust laws on the books and spotlight people who have faced severe penalties simply for sharing or changing their faith. For more information on religious hostility due to apostasy, blasphemy, and anti-conversion laws around the world, visit frc.org/ABA laws. That's frc.org/ABA laws.
Welcome back. I'm Tony Perkins, and you're listening to Washington Watch, the website. If you miss anything on your way home this afternoon, you can find it all later at tonyperkins.com. All right, according to Politico.com, Justice Department officials have communicated to Robert Mueller that the department expects him to limit his congressional testimony, which begins tomorrow, to the public findings of his 448-page report. An extensive discussion since the former special counsel was subpoenaed on June 25th to testify before Congress. Department officials have emphasized that they consider any evidence he gathered throughout the course of his investigation to be presumptuously privileged and shielded from public disclosure. Joining me now to talk more about tomorrow's hearing is Congressman Mike Johnson, chairman of the Republican Study Committee. He is a member of the House Judiciary Committee and will be managing the Republican side of the discussion tomorrow. Congressman, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Hey, Tony. Great to be with you.
All right. What can we expect tomorrow as Robert Mueller appears before your committee?
It's a big question. I personally don't expect many fireworks, except for the surprise witness that they're trying to bring in at the last minute here. I think that'll be resolved. But I expect that Mueller himself will be a pretty straightforward witness. He has a long history of testifying before Congress. He's obviously a bright attorney and does not get ruffled very easily. So I expect that he will stay within the four corners of the of his document, of the report, and that it may be lackluster in terms of what actually comes of his answers.
Why would the Democrats want to bring in a surprise witness if Mueller is supposed to be the center of attention?
That is a great question, isn't it? All of this has been carefully negotiated and decided well in advance. We already pushed this hearing back once because the Democrats weren't happy with the arrangement. So it's all been finalized. It's all obviously greatly anticipated. And here, literally in the 11th hour, they try to pull a fast one. It's a political stunt. I think that they also have estimated that they're not going to get what they want out of this hearing. And so this is an effort to blow it up in a sense that just makes it more controversial in a bigger sideshow and a circus. That's ultimately all they're going to hope to achieve from this. They want to draw attention to the Mueller report and to all of their crazy allegations of collusion and obstruction, and they just won't let it go. But the American people have grown tired of this. They want us to work on the important issues that are facing the country and get beyond that. So hopefully, whatever happens tomorrow, we can begin to move on to the next chapter for the country.
Well, I think I know the answer to this question, but we've had the report. We now have Mueller is going to testify before both the House Judiciary Committee and the Intelligence Committees. Is any answer going to satisfy them? I mean, will they ever move on?
I don't think they intend to. I don't think they'll do that willingly. Look, they've been very open about this. Jerry Nadler is the chairman, the Democrat chairman of our committee and judiciary, and he, of course, has now voted for impeachment. He joins almost 90 Democrats in the House, some of the most liberal members of the Congress who just want to go after the president. And they are just focused on that almost exclusively. And so they don't want this to go away. They want to drag it out as a controversy into the election cycle in hopes and in desperation that this will somehow sway the electorate in November. But I don't, in 2020, I don't think it's going to happen. I think that it's going to backfire on them. And certainly if they try to move the needle on impeachment and they try to go down that road, I think that would definitely backfire on them. I think Nancy Pelosi has estimated that same thing. So that's what they're trying to do, is draw attention to it, create smoke where there is no fire, in hopes that the American people will be swayed to go along with them. I don't think it's going to work.
Well, let me ask you this, Congressman Johnson. You say it could backfire. I mean, could this not be an opportunity for the Republicans in a well-pressed case to put this to rest by showing that there's nothing beyond what has already been publicly released?
Well, that's our intention. You know, we do have lingering questions because so many of our constituents do. So much of the American people and the population are concerned about the origins of the Mueller report. You know, the importance in the beginning of what's now known as the dirty dossier and all of
right.
that. We won't relitigate it all, but those are important questions to ask. I think some of them will be asked tomorrow. I just don't know what sort of substantive answer.
Well, I think you're right. I think what I'm hearing is people want to go beyond the allegations of collusion with Russia to see what the previous administration was doing and the cozy relationships that led to this. I think that's the questions many people are asking.
That's a big question, and questions related to that. You know, in terms of the team of investigators itself, you know, the Mueller team. I mean, it was composed exclusively of Democrats, and some with long histories of donations and even employment with the Clinton Foundation, you know,
right.
with the Hillary Clinton campaign. I mean, it was clearly a group that had at least the appearance of bias, if not outright. And, of course, we all know the infamous examples of a truck-struck page relationship and all everything that came out of that. So there's a lot to dig into there. The question is, how much will we actually get down to the bottom of in a 90-minute hearing at judiciary? I have my doubts about that. But some of these questions may never be answered, Tony, and that's the great tragedy about it.
Well, I tell you what, we will check in with you tomorrow to see what you did find out. Thanks so much for joining us, Mike. We'll talk with you tomorrow.
Thanks, Tony. Appreciate it.
All right, Congressman Mike Johnson of Louisiana, chairman of the Republican Study Committee, member of the House Judiciary Committee, that will be. He'll be managing the Republican side of the discussion tomorrow. And we'll check in with him tomorrow to see what they found out. All right. Doctors sounding the alarm with the U.S. Surgeon General. About what? We'll talk about it next. Don't go away. More to come.
Did you know that babies survive failed abortions? Sadly, many of these babies are denied their human right to life and are allowed to die. Currently, there is no federal criminal statute in place to protect these babies after they are born alive. Congress and state legislatures across the country have responded by putting forth legislation to protect infants who survive abortion. However, leftist politicians have blocked efforts in Congress and in state legislatures to pass the Born Alive Abortion Survivors Protection Act, which requires that life-saving medical care be given to babies born alive after failed abortion attempts. We must decide as a country where we stand on the issue of infanticide, to either pursue humane protections for those most vulnerable in our society or continue to subject innocent human life to the whims of abortionists. For more information, visit frc.org/bornalive.
Today, military personnel are at greater risk than ever of suffering from a mental health condition. On average, 21 active and retired military members take their own lives every day. Richard Gleaston, a military and veteran advocate in the area of mental health, recently shared evidence that faith-based solutions can help stop this crisis. Here's what Richard had to say.
There's new science out that they watch people while they're praying or have a religious relationship. The frontal part of their brain, if I'm correct in remembering what they told me, it strengthens it. It reduces depression, reduces anxiety and stress while you're doing it. So not only did God give us prayer as a way to alleviate our spirit, it also alleviates our mind and our bodies. Our bodies react in a positive way to a faith-based relationship.
Visit frc.org/speakers to hear more.
Did you know that thanks to President Trump, abortion giant Planned Parenthood can no longer receive up to $60 million in federal funding? This new federal protection for the unborn is thanks to a rule change that the Trump administration implemented to the Title X Family Planning Grant Program, which will take effect in May 2019. Not only do the new Title X rule changes take funding away from our nation's largest abortion supplier, they also ensure that taxpayer dollars are not used for abortion and open the door for pro-life pregnancy resource centers and other faith-based organizations to apply for Title X funds, thus expanding the health care options of needy families who are experiencing unexpected pregnancies. For more information about the new Title X rule changes that protect the unborn and increase health care options, visit frc.org/Title X. That's frc.org/Title X.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I'm Tony Perkins. The website, tonyperkins.com. Lots of resources there for you. Also, all of our programs archived at tonyperkins.com. Okay. Leaders of the American College of Pediatricians have sent a letter warning the Surgeon General of the United States about the use of hormonal and surgical interventions for children who are confused about their sex. This is addressed to Surgeon General Dr. Jerome Adams. The letter was signed by Drs. Michelle Cretella and Quentin Van Meter of the American College of Pediatricians, among five others, and advise him that the Royal College of General Practitioners in the United Kingdom has issued an unprecedented warning to the public about harmful hormonal and surgical interventions whose effects on minors have not been subjected to long-term study. Joining me now is Dr. Cretella. She is the executive director of the American College of Pediatricians. Dr. Cretella, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Thanks so much for having me back, Tony. It's great to be here.
Your letter to the Surgeon General sounding the alarm based upon concern expressed by some of your colleagues in the UK. Just how great is this concern that children could be facing long-term negative consequences as a result of these hormonal and surgical interventions?
So a couple things. First, it's clear even in this country there are many, many, many physicians who are deeply concerned about puberty blockers, cross-sex hormones, and double mastectomies and other surgeries being offered to youth.
Now, what age groups are we talking about here?
So puberty blockers are being given to children as young as age 8. Cross-sex hormones are, in other words, girls are being put on testosterone. Even younger than age 12. So we're talking between ages 8 and 12 being pumped full of synthetic hormones, which have serious side effects. In combination, the puberty blockers and the cross-sex hormones together, we're talking sterilization of the children, as well as, I mean, it's ironic because so many on the left are all about sexual pleasure. Well, when you interfere with that pubertal development, you actually short-circuit their sexual development. So we're having kids, we're sterilizing kids and actually preventing them from enjoying sex as adults. It's really crazy when you look at it from that perspective. But then on even the broader scale, you're sentencing them to a lifetime of dependence on these drugs, which put them at risk for heart attacks, strokes, diabetes, cancers, and continued suicidal ideation, continued suicidal thoughts. So this is pure insanity. This is not medicine. This is just awful. This is toxic.
I think you've described it elsewhere, child abuse.
It's institutionalized child abuse. I mean, we have physicians and drug companies profiting off of the suffering of children, suffering, some of which is present in the beginning, right? If some of these kids who are gender confused are suffering from an emotional disturbance, and others are being talked into it by the very people who are supposed to be helping them.
Right. Well, let me quote from your letter here. In the letter to the Surgeon General, you say that 61 to 98% of affected children will outgrow their gender dysphoria if allowed to progress through natural puberty. So, you know, many of these kids that have these, you know, confused thoughts, you know, as they're growing, maturing, I mean, this happens. These procedures are locking them in when, in fact, if they were just left alone in a natural course, the vast majority of them would work their way through it.
Right. Essentially, if some kids may need therapy, sound counseling, psychotherapy, to get at any sort of underlying issues, mm-hmm. But the bottom line is we know that prior to the wholesale promotion of transgenderism, the vast majority of children who were confused about their sex, if they were supported through natural puberty, they outgrew the confusion. That is a fact, and that's been documented in at least 11 studies. But again, that was before all the transgender propaganda. And what we're seeing from the reason we sent this letter now is because in the UK, they have a single gender clinic, the Tavistock Gender Identity Services Clinic. And there we've heard from at least 5 whistleblowers at the clinic itself who are just aghast at what is being done to these children. They've come out and said, look, we have evidence, the clinic has evidence that these children are suffering harm, but that evidence is being suppressed. And then more recently, the Royal College of General Practitioners, as you said, and we refer to in our letter, came out and warned the entire public in the UK that puberty blockers have not been studied and cannot be deemed safe and do risk great harm. So for that reason, we are asking, we're urging our Surgeon General to do the same due diligence. You know, so just as in the UK, they have looked at the science, they've listened to their whistleblowers and said, hey, wake up. This is not science. This is not science. This is a vast experiment that's causing harm. We want that same scientific due diligence to happen here in America. That's what the letter is calling for.
So, Dr. Curtella, as I understand this, these are some medications that in some cases are used for other treatment of other conditions totally unrelated to the transition.
The gender dysphoria.
Mm-hmm. Right. But there's not been long-term studies as to the effect that this can have on children ages 8 to 12 years old, which to me seems really, really unusual that we would openly embrace and promote the use of pharmaceuticals, of drugs, that we don't even know what the long-term effect is.
Right. These children are medically healthy. They're medically healthy. Puberty blockers, you know, puberty's not a disease. if you have a child who goes into puberty too early, that is a disease. And that is the one condition in which the FDA has said, yes, the benefits of puberty blockers outweigh any risk. If you have a child who is going through puberty too early, that's a disease. So, yes, use the puberty blockers for a short period of time. We have studied that. We know the pros and the cons, right? You use the medication to treat a disease. Normal puberty is not a disease. So, therefore, there are no long-term studies of putting healthy children on puberty blockers. What happens, what are some of the side effects when Lupron is the most common drug used for blocking puberty in these healthy children? Well, when Lupron is used appropriately in other diseases, some of the side effects include memory loss of short-term memory, weak bones, very weak bones, bone fractures. We have young women who have, they're experiencing bone fractures and osteoporosis as if they were post-menopause. There's an increased risk in some men of testicular cancer. So this is not a benign drug. It demands research, right? And
all right, Dr. Cortella, I've got a question for you then. When you've listed all of these negative side effects and conditions that result from these hormonal treatments and surgical interventions. I mean, you've talked about sterility, sexual dysfunction, surgical complications, cardiovascular disease, osteoporosis, malignancy, elevated rates of suicide. You know, I'm not a doctor, but I am familiar with the Hippocratic Oath that you're to do no harm. Why is it that doctors are going along with this and not asking questions?
There are many doctors who are asking questions, but they are immediately reprimanded, or they're basically sent for re-education. This is a political issue. It is politicized medicine, and those physicians who are in areas of authority have embraced this ideology over science. Now, some of them honestly believe that they are preventing suicide by giving the kids these medications. But they have that's their belief. That's their personal belief. The science doesn't. There's no science to back it up. There is no science to back it up. The bottom line is, and we know, if you look at the best studies of adults who've gone through the hormones and the surgeries, their completed suicide rates remain almost tremendously higher. In one huge study out of Sweden, their suicide rate was 19 times greater than the general population, even after the hormones and the surgery. So, unfortunately, this is a very politicized topic, and it has become entrenched in medicine and psychology to such an extent that those who do call for the science, they are ostracized. They are persecuted. We have one physician who is suing his former employer because he was fired. He was the chief of child psychiatry in Louisville, University of Louisville Children's, Dr. Alan Josephson. His case is moving forward now. So this is why, for this reason too, for the science, the harm, and the fact that physicians of conscience are having their rights trampled, that's why we have appealed to the Surgeon General.
Have you heard back from the Surgeon General yet?
No, we've not heard back yet, but we certainly intend to follow up. We're not going to let this drop. We we are very much emboldened and encouraged by what's happening across the pond. There's, you know, those whistleblowers at Tavistock were tremendously brave, and I know we have similar, I'm counting on the fact that we've got similar physicians here in this country as well. So in the end, I believe the right thing will happen, because this is about science, and there is not one study to demonstrate any safety or effectiveness of these puberty blockers, cross-sex hormones, or surgeries in kids. Not one long-term study to prove that any of that. And we have plenty of studies to demonstrate that there are risks to these medications.
Well, we will be following this, Dr. Cadella, very closely, and be very interested in the response of the U.S. Surgeon General, because I agree, the evidence suggests that this is not about science. It's about politics for those on the left that are pushing this. And at risk are many, many children who are caught up in this sexual confusion. Thanks so much for joining us again. We'll be tracking this, and we hope to talk to you real soon.
Thanks so much. You have a great day.
All right. Thank you. Dr. Michelle Cretella, Executive Director of the American College of Pediatricians. It's crazy. You know, and you hear this. I was thinking about this. These doctors who question this. I was reading this article out of the UK. You know, they're called transphobic and homophobic if they don't buy into this. Well, I actually think the ones that are silent are the transphobic ones. They're the ones that are afraid. It's not the ones that are speaking out. They're the ones who have the interest of the children and the public at heart. And this is a classic example of why we need to speak truth. You know, I've just been reading in Jeremiah, you know, about how truth died in the streets, where the prophetic voice, the prophets, the priest, were afraid to speak truth to the people because they didn't want to hear it. And what happens? Everything goes the wrong way. There is a standard of truth. We know what is right. Science. You know, science bears out the truth when it's done right. And it's interesting how conservatives were always said to be anti-science, because the science hadn't caught up with the truth, hadn't caught up with revealed truth. Well, you know, if science is done right, whether it's a social science or the physical science, it reveals truth. It's interesting now who rejects science. Gender, biology. Interesting, isn't it? All right, out of time. Thanks so much for joining us. Until next time, I leave you with the encouraging words of the Apostle Paul, found in Ephesians 6, where he says, when you've done everything you can do, when you've prayed, prepared, and taken your stand, by all means, keep standing.
Washington Watch with Tony Perkins is powered by the Family Research Council and is entirely listener-supported. For more information on anything you've heard today, or to find out how you can partner with us in our ongoing efforts to promote faith, family, and freedom, visit TonyPerkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our watch line at 1-866-372-7234. That's 1-866-372-7234.